und herzlich willkommen zum New Work Chat Podcast. Ich bin Gabriel und ich grüße euch aus dem wunderschönen Rostock an der Ostsee, wo ich mit meiner Frau und unseren drei kleinen Töchtern lebe und arbeite. Apropos, um das Thema Arbeit soll es hier im Podcast natürlich gehen, verbunden mit der Frage, wie wollen wir eigentlich unser Leben auf diesem blauen Planeten gestalten? Dazu hole ich mir spannende Köpfe vor das Mikro und frage sie nach ihren größten Learnings und ihren persönlichen Challenges auf dem Weg zu dem, was sie heute tun. Wir reden über vernetztes Arbeiten und disruptives Denken in Zeiten der Digitalisierung, über kulturellen Wandel und über die Frage, wie wir unsere Arbeit mit unserer Familie vereinbaren. Das interessiert mich als Vater von drei Kindern natürlich ganz besonders und da bin ich dankbar für jeden Impuls. Ich selber bin Digitalstratege, blogge seit mehr als 10 Jahren über mein Leben zwischen Daddy-Modus und Digital Life, bin außerdem Teil der 12 Minutes Me Crew und stehe hin und wieder als Rapper auf der Bühne. Ich wünsche euch ganz viel Spaß, lasst mich wissen, wie es euch gefällt. Feedback ist immer willkommen. Viele Grüße, viel Spaß und leinen los. In der ersten Folge des New Work Chat spreche ich mit Luis Suarez, dem Spanier, der auch bekannt ist als Mr. No Email. Ich hatte ihn im September 2018 in Bonn beim IOM Summit kennengelernt, der Konferenz zum Thema Digital Workplace und Cultural Change, zu der sich alles versammelte, was Rang und Namen hat in der Collaboration-Szene. Ich nutzte natürlich die Gelegenheit und hielt nicht nur einen Vortrag zum Thema Digitalisierung in der Ostseesparkasse Rostock, die wir vorantrieben, sondern lernte auch gleich Leute wie Harald Schirmer, Stefan Grabmeier oder auch Luis kennen und tauschte mich mit ihnen aus. Das Thema E-Mail und die Frage, wie wir diesen ganzen Wahnsinn bewältigen, beschäftigte mich natürlich schon lange. Von daher war ich sehr gespannt, was Luis dazu zu sagen hatte. Schon Mashable, das amerikanische Tech-Magazin, hatte über Luis geschrieben, einen Artikel, der viel beachtet war mit dem Titel A World Without Email, One Man's Vision of a Social Workplace. Verlinke euch diesen Artikel gerne in den Shownotes. Ich wollte der Sache auf den Grund gehen und fragte Luis, wie ist das möglich, wie kann man 10 Jahre lang ohne E-Mail leben und nur über Social Networks kommunizieren und arbeiten, und habe mir dabei einige handfeste Tipps und Hacks abgeholt. Das Interview gibt's im Folgenden. Luis saß dabei in seinem Büro auf Gran Canaria, seinem Lebensort, und schaltete sich zu mir nach Rostock in die Familienküche. Daher auch die authentische Akustik. Viel Spaß mit dem ersten Interview.
Hi, Luis.
Hi, Gabriel. How are you? I'm doing very well. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm fine. My wife is bringing the kids to bed, so it's hopefully calm enough to talk about some interesting topics you are working on, and I'm as well.
Cool. Excellent. Looking forward to the conversation. Thank you for having me, by the way. It's great to be here.
Yes. We met last week. Was it last week?
That's right. Bonn? Yes. No, last week, the week before, right?
The week before.
Yeah. At the IOM Summit.
Yes. And this was the IOM Summit in Bonn with the topic Digital Workplace and Cultural Change. Mm-hmm. And, yes, before we jump into that, maybe we introduce ourselves to the audience, to our listeners and viewers. Maybe would you like to start?
Yeah, I'll start. So my name is Luis, Luis Suarez. I am originally from northwest of Spain, although for the last 15 years I have been living in one of the Canary Islands, in Gran Canaria. That's been my home office. And I worked at IBM for 17 years in the area of knowledge management, collaboration, learning, and online communities. And also, I started doing social networking for business around the year 2000, 2001, when I had the first instances of blogs and wikis. And I worked at IBM until 2014. Then I did 2.5, 3 years of freelancing on my own, just to, you know, discover the world and see what else was out there, right? And about 2 years ago, I started working for a firm called Panagenda, based in Austria and Germany mostly, where we focus essentially around data analysis for collaborative environments. So essentially, my work relies a lot on working with customers to help them understand the data they produce when people collaborate behind a firewall. And as a result of that, once you have that understanding, is what kind of decisions you can make that may be better or more smarter in terms of how you run your business, right? I'm also, which is probably what plenty of the viewers may relate to, I'm also that guy who about 10 years ago decided to kill email at work and not use email as much or as often as everyone else was using, and instead using digital tools, social tools, right? And that's been already 10 years. I started in February 2008, and I still do it. I did it when I was at IBM. I did it on my 3 years as a freelancer, and I'm doing it on my pen agenda, right? So it's, I guess that, you know, one of the things that I keep telling people is that once you see the light of not using email, there's no way back. It's just like, you know, you adjust the way you work, the way you interact, the way you collaborate with people. And I mean, I'm obviously there's still people out there who send me emails because it's the only tool that they use. And I go like, okay, I can make an exception, right? But for the, I don't know, 99% of the other interactions, they're all outside. And that's also one of the reasons why most people know me for as a no email guy, while I also promote and advocate for using social tools, enterprise social tools. So how about you?
Yes, I'm 38 years old. I'm from Rostock here. Was raised here at the Baltic Sea. Studied politics and sociology. Then always did my music as a hobby. I have to jump back into English.
Don't worry.
I always did a lot of rapping, like hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the chance to make a little bit more out of it. And I could work with a little music label and not just writing songs and promoting them, but also like selling them and marketing them. And so I got into marketing, and I always loved being creative, like writing and thinking of new ideas to do things. And I started working in an advertising agency in Hamburg. Then our first daughter was born, and we decided to move back to Rostock. Mm-hmm. And then now, 2.5 years back, I started working for a bank.
And, wow, that's a bit of a change.
So everyone was like, what do you do? What the fuck? Why do you work for a bank now? I never planned to do this, but they were looking for someone who should do a really interesting job, like connecting the communication and marketing thing, mm-hmm. the online side with like building the culture and the understanding of the enterprise social network which they introduced, which is IBM Connections, called mm-hmm. OSPA Connect.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my job since then, working with the IT, with HR, and some colleagues here at the communication department, like a lot of social media external, but a lot of social media internal, mm-hmm. and trying to push the cultural change and working with our people. So I was always about connecting people and sharing. That's like very normal to me for a lot of years, this mindset to share and to get what others share. But I think that's a big challenge when you work with companies to explain this and to let them experience what sharing is about. So this is I think a lot about what you do as well.
Yeah, it's been, you know, journey is the right word, right? Because when you decide to embark in this kind of initiatives of helping people open up and becoming more public and transparent and share more of their knowledge and connect and learn together and everything else, you realize that it's something that you decide when to start, but you don't know when it's going to finish, right? There's always the next iteration, the next week, the next conversation, or the next initiatives that you put together. And then when you start thinking about, you know, user behaviors and mindsets and how technology becomes an enabler, you realize that it's a full-time job on its own. And it's a continuous learning curve, right? I mean, you were mentioning a little bit of where you were coming from, and it's actually a nice, diverse way of having different backgrounds that you can then apply to the kind of work that you do now with culture change and change management, right? And what is interesting is that you have all of these usually wild ideas that come from other aspects, like, you know, music and marketing or whatever, and then you apply a lot of creativity to it. And then obviously, for these kind of initiatives, we do need a lot of creativity, because sometimes, you know, you have to, you know, you have that initiative, that intent of helping people understand why that change needs to happen, right? And help them understand as well how it is something that you won't be able to help them unless they help themselves, right? So one of the things that I keep telling people is, and that's, you know, my experience of having worked in this space for over two decades, is that we cannot change people. And you know, I'm really glad that you mentioned that you studied at the very beginning politics and sociology, because sociology is right at the heart of it. And without having and knowing, you know, the studies that you did in that branch or whatever, in that area about sociology, I bet that plenty of what you learned back then at university, you're applying it today in terms of how you work internally to help people open up and help people understand where they're coming from and see their point of view and how they react to different things and why they're reluctant to change, why they're excited about change. How do you enable them? How do you help them understand that they're the ones who need to provoke that change and everything else? And it's one of the things that I keep telling people, that when you talk about all of this change management, it's never been about technology. It's always been about the sociology aspect of how we work, right? It's about, and I know that it's a big word there that everyone is thinking about probably right now, which is culture. And I go, no, it's way beyond culture. It's about behaviors. It's about mindset. It's about values. It's about principles. It's about a way of life, frankly. I mean, I was talking earlier on about how, you know, I have been working in three very different environments, large corporation, on my own, and then working now for a relatively smaller firm than a large corporation and everything. And in all of those, I basically still do no email after 10 years, right? And the reason for that is because I have adjusted already my mindset as a way of life. It's how I live, right? So to me, whenever I interact with people, the last thing that I think about is, oh, let me go and fire you an email. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to look for other ways where I can have a much more meaningful conversation than an email thread. And it's always been like that, right?
But I have to ask you about the no email thing. How do you communicate instead?
So one of the things that happens, and the reason why I'm thinking a little bit about it before I say anything, is that over the course of those 10 years, I have learned a lot, right? And I have learned a lot, not only about how people work, but also how I work. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to reach a compromise, right? I negotiate. So typically the first time that I talk to someone, and, you know, whether it's a face-to-face interaction or whether it's happening online or whether someone sends me an email, the first thing that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to evaluate how long that relationship is going to be. I mean, are we talking here for something quick and dirty of, hey, I need something like this, can you help me? Or is it more like a medium long-term relationship where I get to build conversations and I get to learn and we get to learn and everything else, right? So depending on those answers, so if it is a quick and dirty one, I'll try to get rid of it as soon as I can, right? And if that means responding via email and say, hey, you want that? Here you go, bye. And good luck, right? If it is something where we need to develop a working relationship, a business relationship over the course of time, what I usually do is I ask people, what else, apart from email, do they feel comfortable with, right? And I get lots of different answers. You know, people tell me, I do a lot of Twitter, I do a lot of LinkedIn, I do WhatsApp, I do a Slack, I do Teams, I do a lot of file sharing. I work on files and everything else. So they tell me all sorts of various different things that make them comfortable when working, along with email. So email, I just, you know, pick it up, package it, and then lift it aside or move it aside. And then I say, okay, so what else are you comfortable with? And they usually tell me any of those tools. So what I do then is I just basically adjust to their comfort zone by going to them and interacting with them in those different tools. So in my experience, once you do that, what you do is you lower the barrier of entry with that person. So eventually, if you come up to the turf, if you come up to the territory, they will be keener on talking to you because you are already compromising on saying, you know, I don't need to go anywhere else. They actually come to me. In this case, I'm coming to them, right? Okay. So what happens is that usually when they tell me, you know, this is where I feel more comfortable apart from email, we eventually focus on the conversations, on what they want to do and what they want to achieve versus trying to figure out how to use a tool. And then eventually, over the course of time, by interacting with them that way, they realize that they don't need email any longer. So the next time that I interact with them, they come directly through that other tool that they use. And eventually, it helps them become a lot more open and transparent in terms of how they work with me. And in my return, I do exactly the same thing. I try to be as open and as transparent and as knowledge-sharing prong as I can be. Now, what happens from that is that the moment that you establish that kind of relationship, the whole conversation changes because you focus more on the work that you need to do versus how you want to do it, right? And because most of these digital tools, you know, like you guys, for instance, are using IBM Connections, they are relatively easy to use in terms of not having a very steep learning curve and maybe taking, I don't know, 1-2 hours to get the gist of something major that you want to do, you're just quite nicely. What is interesting from what I learned from people is that people are used to working on one single tool where they do everything, which is email, right? They treat email as a whole in terms of if it doesn't happen through email, it didn't happen, right? And when I tell them that I have a handful of tools, so say, I don't know, 6, 10, 12 tools that I use at any given point in time, they'll go like, so how is that going to make you more effective? I mean, we go from one single tool into multiple different tools. And I basically tell them something that I learned over the course of time as well, which is working fragmentation. Fragmentation for me is good. It's actually a healthy behavior for my brain. And the reason why I'm saying that is because our brains, our human brains, they function as fragments. We process information in small fragments, not as a whole, which is why the inbox is such a mess. Whereas if I know that I use a particular tool for one particular client, I know that when I need to contact that client or work with that external party, I need to go to this tool and only this tool. So I channel through my focus area into one specific kind of interaction using one particular tool and everything else. So eventually, I'm much more focused in terms of what I do because I don't have to go and navigate through the maze of, oh my God, look at all of these emails coming in, all of these folders, all of these documents, all of this. No, I just basically go and divide my workload in fragments, right? And depending on the need of what I need to do at that point, I go for one option or the other. So to me, something that is very important when interacting and collaborating with people is context. So depending on what I want to do, I will go for one tool or the other. Right. But I always compromise in terms of asking people, you know, what else apart from email do you feel comfortable with? And whatever they tell me, I'll go and use that. There are a couple of exceptions that there are a couple of tools for which I would not use. Right. But then those tools that people are using, they're mostly for personal use, which, you know, they're not business related. So whatever people do in their personal time, that whatever else. Right. And one of them is Facebook. I don't have a Facebook account.
One second, please. I have to get the charger.
Yeah, go ahead. Don't worry. So, like I was saying, I don't use Facebook. I did it to my account 6 years ago, and I haven't worked back. Now, in my experience, a lot of the people that I used to interact with, that I still work with, they don't use Facebook for business. They use it more for personal, private, family interactions, or whatever. But anything else, I'll go and compromise and use that. Right. And like I said, it's really interesting to see how much you can have access to if you give in to how people work. So instead of telling people, come and work on MySpace. If you actually do the opposite, if you tell people, you know, where do you work? I will go there. You basically achieve a whole lot more. What happens as well as a result of that, which is what I mentioned earlier on as well, and I wrap up with that, is that once you show them how much more comfortable they can get on that new social tool, they never walk back to email. And that's exactly when I went, right? So I invest my time a little bit in terms of learning about the tools, how to work with the tools. And once I know how to work with the tools, then I can offer that as an option. And when people take it and then they can start, or they start using the tools, then they realize that, heck, why should I use email if this works beautifully, right? And that's when I get all of that time back of not having to work with email anymore.
Very interesting. I think we all have the situation that we have to deal with the information overload on the business side, on the private side. Everybody prefers another channel, like you said. And sometimes I think it's hard to know where somebody wrote a message. Sometimes it's really hard to remember.
It is, but you know,
looking, was that Facebook chat? Was that Xing, LinkedIn, whatever? Right. And then next time too.
It does. But here's the thing, and this is what is really important about the use of all of these digital tools, that somehow it's a skill that we need to develop versus how we used to work with email. You mentioned about, you know, information overload. Clay Shirky, about, gosh, maybe 10, 12 years ago, actually mentioned that there's no information overload, there's filter failure, right? Now, what happens with that filter failure is how we set up those filters. So one of the things that I have learned in terms of a new skill that I acquired over the course of time is, you know, you have got this concept of FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. I actually acquired JOMO, which is joy of missing out. So I learned to let it go. I learned to understand that I cannot be in all possible places. I cannot respond to all possible messages, and I cannot connect with every single person that contacts me. So I have got limitations, both, you know, from my brain capacity as well as my physical time that I have to dedicate and everything else. So I have learned as a skill for JOMO to ask questions to people. You know, if someone says something to me and contacts me, and they say, yeah, remember that conversation that we had, I don't know, 6 months ago on LinkedIn, as an example? I go like, you know what, frankly, I don't. Can you point me to it? And they will point me to it, because eventually, you know, I have made them clear that I cannot possibly in all places. So it's okay for me to miss things out. In my experience, one of the things that I have learned from doing that is that if it's okay to miss out on things, right? Because if it is something really important, if it is something really, 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 really important that you need to pay attention to, that you need to do, it's always going to come back and back and back and back till you eventually pay attention to it, right? So what I learned from that is that I can actually process a lot more information and a lot less information than I used to through email, because I focus more on the conversations that I have with people than where I store the content that I create. I no longer care about that. And the reason why I no longer care about that is because I'm much more interested in what's in people's heads than in what people write. You know, this goes back again to how our brains work, right? So from what we think to what we say to what we write, there's three different worlds. So I want to focus on the first one, the one that has not processed into codifying any kind of knowledge, right? And you do that through building relationships with people, which is why I invest a lot of my time in having conversations with people without having to focus on creating content and then store it somewhere else to never see it again, right? I prefer to go and have that network of contacts that I can rely on just as much as they can rely on me. And the only way for me to do that effectively is through all of these social tools versus email. It just doesn't cut it. Email doesn't cut it for me. To me, it becomes a Pandora's box, right? Where it's got the worst. And the way of how we have abused it over time has made it even worse. Now, the thing is that you would say, yeah, but on digital tools, in social tools, you also see people abusing the system. And I say, yeah, but they show themselves how silly and stupid they are, which means that I'm going to park them out and say, I'm not interested in you because you're abusing the system. Whereas an email, because everything is private and hidden and opaque, you can get away with whatever it is, right? I mean, there were a number of different reasons why I left email 10 years ago, right? One of them was because it was a delegation machine of work from someone else dumped into me. And because no one saw it, because it was a private exchange, there's that pressure that somehow you need to do it because someone is asking you to do it, right? So when I stopped doing that, and I actually started telling people, you know, if you want to work with me, you will have to open up. And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, don't work through email. If you need to ask me something, ask publicly so that people know what you're asking. And I can tell you what the potential answers are. And if I don't know the answers, then I can invite my network to help you out as well. So you get the best of both worlds. You get the best of me and my abilities, but you also get the best of my network, right? By opening up, right? And then obviously that cut off entirely all of those different interactions from people who basically just wanted to dump their work on you so that you would get it done and they would get the credit. No, that wasn't my thing. You know, I eventually ended up telling people, you know what, I'm not here getting paid to do your job. I'm here to get paid to do my job as part of a network, as part of a collective, right? And that's eventually what I did, right? And that was one of the reasons as to how I started it 10 years ago, right? There were a couple of other things, but that was actually one of the major ones because I was seeing how people were essentially trying to dump their workload because they were, you know, overloaded or whatever into everyone else, and everyone else would do the job, and then they would get the credit for having done the work because no one could see that. I said, I'm sorry, but that's not a collaborative way of getting work done. And I stopped it.
I think it's a really a big challenge to change the habit of mailing, because people are used to it for years and centuries, and in our case it was so that our IT manager Sven Bratke, who's also really pushing it, he said we have to introduce a tool like IBM Connections or something like this, a social intranet. Mm-hmm. The management board said, okay, we can do it, green lights. So they took the tool, and Alexander Kluge, who you know, helped, and they had a lot of plans. But the people were not used to the tool and to the way of communicating, like open and transparent and sharing. So what they did and what a lot of them still do is they have their notifications, right, in the tool, and every time I write something adding someone, they get a notification in their mail box.
Yeah.
And then they answer me in mail to the notification,
so then
I get the mail from them, which is like the notification. Then I go back to the enterprise social network and write, "Oh, I got your mail." This, and right, then they get the notification, and it's like a circle.
Right.
So, and the question, or my question is, you said we cannot change people.
Right.
But we have to try to change the habit to communicate, and what, right, would you recommend? How can we do this?
Right. So here's the thing. So in my experience of having worked in the space of social software for like I said, you know, nearly 20 years now, when I started using my first instances of blogs and wikis, there used to be a time when I used to think that I could change people. You know, I could conquer the world, you know, that social business evangelist, like with the spirit of being super positive, hyperactive, and being all over the place, I can change everyone. Reality taught me otherwise, right? Reality taught me that it's really hard to change people's habits, especially when the current habits they have, they're relatively easy for them to get their work done, like email, right? So that's very difficult to change. So what I said to myself was, you know what, I need to shift from trying to change people into trying to change the system, right? Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what I focus on. If you change the system, people will eventually change. Why? Because they won't have a choice out any longer, right? So changing the system means that you need to be able to identify how the system works. So data analysis, for instance, is very good for that, right? So for instance, you will have, so I'm going to use an example in here. So through data analysis, for instance, you can find the worst offenders of people who abuse email, right? You can also find out about how people are using email on a daily basis to promote whatever the behaviors. Now, changing people will go and will be going back to them and say, like, why are you sending 400 emails a day, Mr. or Mrs., right? That will be like trying to change people. Trying to change the system will be, wow, we're using a lot of emails to actually share documents. So how about if we stop sharing documents via email and then we place them into connections, as an example, right? That's changing the system. So you eventually entice people to make use of a different tool for that, right? Now, one of the things that I did when I was back at IBM, I actually developed 40 different use cases of how people used email and how they could do those same 40 use cases elsewhere, right? In connections or whatever other social intranet. And the idea was that if I was capable of showing the old habit with the new habit and the benefit that I got of that transition from the old habit to the new habit, then people will go and say, like, whoa, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So if I actually do this, I will get that kind of productivity gain, right? Or I will become more effective at doing X, Y, Z. So eventually what you see is that you basically, and this is what it's all about, you basically provide the conditions for people then to decide if they want to change or not. And if in those conditions, you give them an opportunity to find a better value for what they do, believe me, they will change their habits. It's going to take time. It's going to take effort, but they eventually will change and will adjust. The focus is not on going back and telling people, hey, you need to stop using email, but it's more, how about if we define a new way of working based on these additional new benefits that we didn't have before? So for instance, to give you an example, because probably this is better with an example, right? So when I started doing this no email thing in IBM 10 years ago, one of my major use cases, because this is all about use cases, is how people work, right? Activities, behaviors, mindset. So one of those use cases for me was file sharing. I was, you know, doing a lot of public speaking and I was reviewing and helping other colleagues with their public speaking. So I basically sent and received lots of presentations, right? Now, at the time at IBM, I had an issue with mail quotas where I could only receive up to a certain amount before I would be locked out. And that was 150 MB, which usually was like 4 or 5 presentations, and then I was locked out, right? So that meant that every single week, and I remember this, every single week on Friday afternoon, I had to spend 2-3 hours every week to clean up my inbox, to reduce the size of my inbox so that I could email back again, right? Bit of a punishment. We call it at the time like mail jail, right? And it felt like that. Right. So I said, okay, so that's a behavior. That's a habit that I do now. That's a use case that I do now. So that's the old world. The new world is where from a certain point onwards, I decided to never share a document via email. And eventually I moved all of my presentations into connections files. And I encourage everyone to do the same just for the heck of trying it. Right. And what I did was I basically started observing how people were very shyly going and, you know, sharing one file 1 week and another file another week and all that stuff. But they were doing it, right? Now, I was doing all of them. So at the end of the month, the first month that I was doing that, I was telling them, you know, I said to them, you know what, you know, pick up one use case. That use case is sharing files. So here's the old behavior through email. Here's the new behavior through connections files. And here's the benefit, guys. And my benefit was for people, you know, from this time onwards, every single week, I was saving 2 or 3 hours to do something else because I no longer needed to do housekeeping on my email. And then people told me, yeah, but, you know, that's only like 2-3 hours per week. And I said, yeah, but multiply that by 600,000 people doing the same thing that I'm doing.
That's money.
And everyone, exactly. And everyone went like, whoa, yeah, I know what you mean now about use cases. And that was exactly it. It's how you pick up with the lowest barrier of entry as possible as you can, and how you then amplify it by having colleagues following you doing the same thing, right? And I know that you're going to tell me, yeah, but how do you get people to transition from one to another? And I said, time investment. right? At the time when I was doing it, I never got stopped from working with anyone where I would offer my time to them to explain them in over the course of 5 minutes how to share files in a social space, right? If I had the opportunity to work from office, I would even invite them for a coffee, right? So like I would say, yeah, do you have like 5 minutes for a coffee? And I can show you how it works. You know, when you look into all of these digital tools, they're big, giant beasts that you do lots of different things, lots of different interactions. But when you narrow down to one single use case, to one specific feature and one specific capability, that's 5 minutes of your work. So initially, I remember 10 years ago, how I spent lots of 5 minute chunks, right? Training people here, training people there, over instant messaging, over a phone call, over a web meeting, over a face-to-face contact, whatever it was. So I did tons of that 5 minute investment. And at one point in time, that stopped completely. Why? Because everyone that I was working with, and believe me, I was working in multiple projects with multiple teams, they were working my way. So I made a little bit of a time investment to say, you know, I'm going to show you how I work, and then I'm going to tell you what the benefit is. And then you can decide if you want to do it. Oh, and by the way, I can do that in 5 minutes. Can you deny me 5 minutes? Most people are going to tell you, no, I cannot deny you 5 minutes because 5 minutes is 5 minutes, which is a very short time. And eventually, I learned how people stop using email that I was working with, and they started moving and using connections for that, right? So what I learned from that is that you need to be patient. It takes time. You need to persevere. You know, there may be a situation where people need more than multiple five-time chunks. That's okay. I can do that, right? And eventually, it's also, and this is what I think was really important, and I only know this 10 years later, right? Is that if you show people how you work, so if you lead by example, people pay more attention than if you tell them what they need to do and then you go and do something else, right? So they could see me as a live example of how things were happening, right? I mean, as an example, as an anecdote, I just connected with a former colleague of mine through LinkedIn, who just, you know, bumped into me in one of the LinkedIn algorithms. And we used to work together at IBM. Right? She was in the learning space. I was in the social enablement, the social business enablement. And she said, you know what? It's great to connect with you in here because after all of these years, I still think of you every Monday morning when I come to work and I have 1,000 emails. And I went like, that's it. That's as good as it gets. You know, people remember by what you did, not what you told them to do. So it's, you know, and this applies to this quote by Mohammed Gandhi, right? That be the change in the world be the change that you want to change in the world in a way, right? And I know that quote is not really, but you guys know what I mean, right? I'm sure that you guys have seen that quote. So the idea is you be yourself, the one who exposes your workload, the one who tries to do that. So the example that you gave is perfect, right? You go into connections, you use a mention, you invite someone else into the conversation, and then they respond to you via email. That's, you know, painful and frustrating because you're encouraging them to go into connections and they still use email, but then persevere one more time, right? So you get, and that's exactly what you do. You gather the content, you pick up the content, and then you share it on the same conversation that you had in connection. So at one point in time, that's going to tick for people. And instead of responding to you via email, they're going to go and respond back into connections. And the other thing about, you know, having those alerts, one of the things that I keep telling people is that that's no longer email. That's actually known as BACN, B-A-C-N, which is essentially email turned into an aggregator, right, of content that is elsewhere. So it's an alerting system versus a content repository. I'm okay with that because you can use email, you can use an RSS newsfeed reader, you can use alert systems on your mobile phone. So it doesn't bother me. What is important from that is that the content is no longer trapped in your inbox so that only you can see it. In the example that you gave, everyone else can see. Everyone else can see that you're having a conversation with someone else that you're inviting through a mention and that they trigger a response and that you take the care to respond back still on the connections thread or the connections conversation. What is interesting from what you're doing, Gabriel, is that you're using a lot of patience, and I know that you're using a lot of patience in that regard because you keep going back to that new way of working. right? While there are people who basically want to still remain on the old system of using email. Give them time. Eventually it will tick, because there's something there that I learned as well that can be very, very powerful, which is social pressure. The moment that you have one or two people doing the same stuff that you're doing, then you will have four, then you will have 10, then you will have 15, then you will have 100, 500, 5,000, and before you know it, you have the entire organization doing it, right? It's the way I describe it when I started doing the no email thing, and you know, but this is, like I said before, February 2008, everyone thought that I was crazy doing this. You know, you're going to have like 2 weeks and then you're going to be fired, because we are an email-driven company. You know, we even sell email software, right? So I thought, like, you know what? I'm going to try it. I'm going to be, you know, swimming against the current. You know, if the current goes this way, I'm going to go that way. See what happens, right? Well, I didn't get fired. I actually, you know, was doing that for, you know, 2008 until 2014, when I left the company to move into something else or whatever. So I didn't get fired for that. And what I realized about it is that I went in against the current, but at one point in time, I became the current when more and more people started doing the same thing that I was doing. And a lot of those other people who were just doing email, they were getting isolated to a certain extent, because there were conversations were happening elsewhere than their email inboxes. And they eventually had to find their value to go where everyone else was. Right. So one of the things that I was very conscious about was, if I needed to share something really important, was to never do it via email, to always do it on open systems. So that's also triggering a mindset shift in my behavior, where from a very early days, so this is way before, I don't know, social networks became social networks, around 2002, 2003, I realized that once you share your knowledge openly, is no longer your knowledge, is your network's knowledge. And that's the best you can get. When the people around you know what you know, that's the next way for you to go into the next level of learning something else, because your network will come and help you just as long as you keep helping them, right? So it's a reciprocal game of give and take. I help you today, you help me tomorrow. But it's how you nurture relationships, through that trust exchange, right? And it takes patience. It takes patience because, like you said, people don't change overnight, right? But if you look into it, we all change. It's just that we don't want to admit it to ourselves, or we don't want to admit it at work, but we change in our habits, in our behaviors or whatever, but it always needs to be done in our terms. And that's how I, you know, there are people who tell you that they drive adoption. I hate that narrative, because it looks like you're pushing someone over the edge, right? I'd rather prefer for people to tell, you know, persuasion. I'm persuading my colleagues to think different and do different, and see how good your persuasion is, right? Because there you actually need to work hard to get people's attention and have them walk your way. And eventually, when you are a leading example, so when you walk your talk, it's very difficult for people to say no.
Yeah, I'm just reading the book How to Win Friends from Dale Carnegie, and I'm sure you know it. And he said you can't similar. You can change people, but if you want to something like change people, you have to make them want it. If you want them to do something, you have to let them discover it. Like they have to understand what's in it for them.
Which is, if you look into it, that's one of the major issues that all of these change management initiatives have, because they have never stopped asking what's in it for you as the end user, what's in it for you as the knowledge worker. The, you know, change management had a very big problem of trying to think for the people that they were trying to execute on change, right? Without asking them, what they were doing. And I know that some people may say, yeah, but that's why we did surveys, that's why we did interviews. I say, yeah, but of a very small sample population, you didn't do it for every single one of the employees, because each and every one of them will have its own what's in it for me. If you have not been able to answer that, you're not going to go anywhere, right? And that's one of the things that in most cases, once you can identify the what's in it for me, for everyone else, for the people that you work with, you realize that you have got different ways of how you can persuade them and influence user behavior by understanding what triggers them, right? And one of the things that I keep telling people about it, and this is what I mentioned earlier on, you know, this is not a trip, this is a journey, you know, and the larger the organization is, the longer the journey is going to be because you have to cover more ground, right? But it's a worthwhile journey because it's a constant learning curve. You know, you're constantly learning from what people are doing, from what they're conversing, what they're sharing, what they're actually working on projects or whatever else. And it gives you an opportunity to understand how the organization works. And if you understand how the organization works, then you can find ways to try to change the way people work, right? Going, again, aiming at the system and not at the individual.
I really share what you said. It's a lot about, I think it's a lot about a cultural change in a company, which is also driven by the young people who come into the company. For a lot of them, it's normal to share there on Snapchat and all the other, like Instagram, the other networks. And sometimes they can show the management board how to use it why they do it, why they take photos of their food and so on. And what I would like to ask you maybe as the last question for this talk, mm-hmm. You know, I have two little daughters and I have to raise them. And sometimes I ask myself, what are the most important things to teach them for them to be ready for the digital future where AI plays a role and everything is connected, the smart home, etc., you know. And what do you think are the most important skills for them in the future?
Wow, that's a very big question, right? I'm not sure if I will be able to answer it because obviously, you know, your daughters... Right, yeah, but I tell you what I think, and I actually have been asked that question in the past twice, and without giving it much thought, my first reaction is teach your kids what Google doesn't. And then people say, like, what do you mean? I say, like, think about what I just said. Teach them what Google doesn't teach them, right? So, you know, with Google, you can basically find all sorts of various different information. You can find news items, you can find videos, you can find articles, white papers, you can find people. You can do anything in terms of searching for information. What is key as a skill is making sense of the information, being able to distinguish between what's bullshit and what's actually truth, what is actually fact, right? So eventually, one of the most important skills that I think we will need to acquire, especially in the next decade, is critical thinking skills. And I know that this may sound really crazy, but we need to teach our younger generations, and teaching is the wrong word, we need to tell them, question everything. Question everything. And don't be convinced with just the first answer because probably is not the right answer, right? So critical skills will be critical thinking, sense making, and then what Google doesn't teach you, which is essentially about how to be a human being. You know, how to be compassionate, how to care for people, how to understand people, how to listen to people, how to connect with people, how to relate to people. I mean, you were mentioning earlier on about how these younger generations, they share pictures of the food they have on Snapchat or Instagram or whatever. That's social capital. Back in the old KM world, the old knowledge management world, that was one of the most precious things that people would do, which was essentially share that social capital that was the ability for people to build relationships based on affinities, common interests, likes and dislikes, and everything else. The difference between 25 years ago and now is that now it's all visual, it's all through pictures, and back then it was through internet relay chat or the youth groups nets, you know, the youth group nets, so the forums, the traditional forums, and even email as a social capital builder, right? When people were subscribed to distribution lists, right? So those skills are essentially what plenty of people have known as soft skills, but it's actually a lot harder to acquire than any other skill because they actually question your own humanity. You know, it's how do you become more empathic? How do you become more caring for what people do? How do you pay attention to people when they talk to you? How do you listen, right? And how do you make sense of the world around you by being that critical thinker, right? So those will be kind of the skills that I will try to inspire in the new generations. And along the lines always of questioning everything, right? Whether it's the truth or it's false or it's a lie, questioning everything, because there's a great chance that whatever you get told the first time may not be the truth. Right, or it may not be something that you can then contrast with whatever else. Right, the interesting thing in here is that in my experience, the younger generations are actually quite all right on their own. They don't need they don't need the directives that we used to when we were a lot younger. Right. Because they learn pretty quick amongst themselves. They have ability to connect with people and relate to people like really quick as a result of how they interact with others and how they learn from others, right? What I would do as well as part of, helping those younger generations acquire their new set of skills is I would also focus on the not so young generations. So people of our age, right? The late 30s, 40s, right? Because, and I was having a conversation alone this morning about it, that generation very soon, in say 2020, 2025, they will become the vast majority of the active working population, and they will need to make a choice. And that is choose the old world or the new world. If I want to choose the old world, things are going to continue being like they are today, right? They will perpetuate the status quo. If they choose a new world, the younger generations, like your daughters and everyone else, they will be all right because they have already adjusted to that mindset from the very young age, right? So to your question, I think the focus is not just on those younger generations, but it's also on the new leaders that are becoming the new leaders in the next 2, 3, 5 years, right? Those are the ones that we need to work on. The rest, in case people are wondering, they can retire because they are not worth the fight. And I'm sorry to sound this blunt, but if someone would ask me what's the major obstacle right now from change management and all these change initiatives with social tools, it's actually that generation, that, senior management and senior leadership. They are a hurdle. They're an obstacle. And the reason for that is because if they weren't, we would have changed the nature of work about 10 years ago. And 10 years later, here we are, feeling that we haven't even started in this transformation journey, right?
Mm.
So yes, that's my piece of advice. Take it with a pinch of salt or two, please.
Thank you, Lewis.
My pleasure.
I think we should continue this one time. But for the moment, thank you for giving us some insight in your no mail concept and how you do it, why you do it, and thank you for sharing.
My pleasure. Anytime. I will be more than looking forward to the next one where we can pick things up in terms of other conversations and tips and tricks of how we can get it done and everything. So thanks for hiring me today. It's lovely.
Thank you, Lewis. Bye.
Bye.
Und das war's auch schon wieder mit dem Interview. Ich hoffe, es waren ein paar spannende Ideen auch für euch dabei. Schreibt mir gerne euer Feedback zur Folge per Mail oder auch als Kommentar auf newworkchat.de oder direkt auf gabrielrath.com. Würde mich auch freuen, wenn ihr das Ganze supportet, bewertet den Podcast, schreibt Kommentare auf iTunes. Ihr wisst, dass wir dadurch eine Sichtbarkeit bekommen und dass so auch noch mehr Leute davon mitbekommen. Wenn ihr unbedingt mal einen Gast in diesem Podcast hören wollt, auch dann sagt gerne Bescheid. Ich freue mich über Anregungen und freue mich über Empfehlungen aus dem Netzwerk. Insofern viele Grüße aus Rostock in die große weite Welt. Bis zur nächsten Folge und bleibt connected. Ciao.